This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black families have always had to teach their children how to cope in a racist society. But do white kids also need to be taught how not to be racist? A new book explores that question. And we talk with an author who says hip-hop culture provides insights on how to create a new kind of society.
But first, the United States overthrew Haiti's elected government in 2004. But 15 years later, the Haitian people are in the streets demanding that their U.S.-backed president step down. President Jovenel Moïse is charged with looting the nation's finances. A delegation from the OAS, the Organization of American States, lectured Haitians to end their street actions and wait for elections. Daoud André is a Brooklyn-based radio host and an activist with the Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti. He says the OAS has nothing to offer the Haitian people.
I think your listeners should know or do know that the Organization of American States, this is a U.S. lackey organization. Folks who didn't know it before should look at the role that they are playing right now in Venezuela in helping the United States work towards the ouster of the legitimate president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. We are happy to see that it has failed so far. But the OAS, we are in this situation with Jovenel Moïse in Haiti because of the work of the OAS and Obama and Hillary Clinton in installing Michel Martelly. Was installed by them when he really had no, he came in something like fifth in the process in 2010. And it's shenanigans of the OAS that got him there. And then further shenanigans, they installed Jovenel Moïse, although it was not a real election. And by their own numbers, less than 500,000 people in a country of about 12 million people, they say voted for Jovenel Moïse. So their presence in Haiti, after the people have once again been in the streets since the 9th of June, nothing is functioning in the country, no transport, no schools are open, no businesses are open. They're keeping the airport open only to prop up the government. And when we heard that the OAS was going to Haiti, people were saying for a dialogue. Well, many of us said, what kind of dialogue when this is someone that they themselves put in power? So yesterday when we saw what is supposed to be the results of their dialogue with Jovenel Moïse and with the opposition, what they're basically saying is for Jovenel Moïse to continue with the death squads, killing the people who are protesting in the streets, who are demanding his ouster. And they are saying the same thing that Kenneth Merton, former U.S. ambassador to Haiti and the official at the State Department afterwards, when in November, when the people were in the streets again and Merton said they have to wait for elections, that the United States agrees that people have the right to protest, but the only way for the government to change is through elections. And Venezuela, again, gives the lie through this attitude of the United States. This is for people who might not be aware of the role that the United States has played, not just in Latin America, but all over the world, in toppling governments for hundreds of years, we should say. Almost since the creation of the United States, they've been meddling in the affairs of other countries. And so the people who are in the streets in Haiti, burning tires, demonstrating, and doing what they have to do to get rid of this government, the OAS is irrelevant to them, just as the United States of America is irrelevant to them. The fight between the descendants of our ancestors who are trying to get back to a free and emancipated country, it continues. And the lackeys of our enemies, they are there in the country, the elite, also fighting with the support of their puppet masters to stay, to keep our country in the condition, you know, Mr. Trump aptly described the state of our country. We don't need to repeat that word again, but as we say, it is in that condition because of the work of the United States, because of the work of France, what they call the international community. And this is what our people are in the streets fighting against. This is not just about, you know, the Petrocaribe billions of dollars that disappeared. And yeah, some people are asking for this money back, but we don't expect this money back. We are in the streets also asking the Clintons what happened to the $6 billion from the earthquake. We know that Haiti is never going to get this money back, but it's a fight to free ourselves from these forces that continue to try to dismantle the fight that we had for our liberation in 1804. This is what's going on. This is what is continuing right now, Glenn.
Yes, the OAS delegation, headed up by Americans, did not meet with the people who've been organizing the demonstrations in the streets. Who are those organizations?
It's not one organization organizing protests. It's the entire country that is locked up from one end to the other, you see. And the people have no reason to meet with the OAS. They have no reason to negotiate with the OAS, to sit down with the OAS. The people who the OAS would try to sit down with in any event, their lackeys, the people that are already in the pockets of the United States, the people who, like one of them, he's a multimillionaire lottery magnate who became head of a political party. And speaking about amnesty for the people who stole the Petrocaribe money. But the people in the streets, they have nothing to do with people like that. And I should tell you that yesterday, after news came out that this was the proposition from this man, Eric Jean-Baptiste, who is now the head of RDNP, Milan Maniga's party, is they, in their protests everywhere, they came across the lottery booths, it's called Pellet and El Bolet, they tore them apart and set them on fire just as a way to say that this is not even going to fly. We're not going to even listen to this kind of garbage. So there's nothing to negotiate. It's like, you know, you have slavery and what are you going to sit and discuss? Are you going to sit and discuss whether Martelly, Jovenel, how much they're going to give back? Nobody's going to give back anything they got. It's either them or it's us. It's the people. And clearly, as we said in the beginning, the OAS is in the pocket of the United States. It's a lackey organization for the United States. I think it was Fidel Castro who called it the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the United States. Whatever the United States finds too ugly, too a transparent for them to push for themselves, they go to the OAS to deal with that. And so it's an organization with no credibility And as a matter of fact, the people had given warnings to those who pretend to leadership of the opposition that we have no dialogue with the OAS, just like we have no dialogue with the United States, because they are at the source of the reality that Haiti has been in for hundreds of years right now.
Judging by the tone of the OAS delegation's statement, in which they admonished the president, telling him, you have to govern. Right now, you're not governing. Well, it seems like President Moïse's patrons are upset with him. Do you think maybe a change of regime from the patrons might be coming?
Well, they should try and do what he can't do. The man, Jovenel Moïse, cannot get out of his house right now, Glenn. So there is, the National Palace has been down since the earthquake, and they have, like, what do you call it? A trailer in the palace yard. This is where supposedly the government, the seat of government, but Jovenel Moïse cannot get from his house to the seat of government. And the OAS, if they think that he's not doing enough or he's not strong enough, they should try and do it themselves.
You seem to be saying that Moïse and his cronies have stolen so much they can't even repair the palace or get to it.
No, the thing is that last week, Jovenel Moïse, for the first time, came out of the hole that he's been hiding in. And people had gathered around. It was a celebration ceremony for the 24th anniversary of the police force. And I have to tell you that after President Aristide disbanded the army that was a child of the U.S. occupation in 1915, that's when they created this army that President Aristide disbanded. Well, Jovenel Moïse was there, but he could not get out. He could not get out of this event. And more than an hour after he had finished speaking, other people had left, but Jovenel Moïse could not get out. They had to practically break down a wall at another point in the perimeter of this space. And they almost had an accident. They almost killed policemen who were in the area. He escaped. That's how he got out of that space, because people were waiting for him. So what I'm saying basically is that, of course, he's not governing, because to govern a people, you have to have a minimum of legitimacy or enough to impose. Jovenel is not in any position to impose anything right now. Nobody takes him seriously inside or outside of the country. And by them, they know that he's going to go. It's a question of time. And what they're doing by doing all of this is to buy time and to try to cajole, to try to bribe people that they have to bribe. But it's not just in Port-au-Prince, the capital, that there is widespread protests. It's like fires are burning all over the country. And what the OAS and the United States would like Jovenel Moïse to do, it's an impossible task for him to do. And basically, I think that what they're doing is trying to negotiate an after Jovenel Moïse right now to see what would be less detrimental to them. But they have to save face. They have to pretend, and they have to mislead. And so this is what this mission was about. But they know right now that Jovenel Moïse is not governing anything. They know that he cannot govern anything. And everything is shut down in the country. And the government is not even able to pay its own officials. They're not able to collect any taxes. There are national exams for school children that are coming up. But this is impossible to happen because the government cannot ensure that these children will even get to the exams. And, you know, there have been protests basically all year, and schools have been closed so many days. So some people were saying, you know, what's even the point of these exams? It's a national mobilization to just get rid of this government right now. And for some of us, it's not just this government, but this system that is a system that exists by the dictates of the US and Europe, and to create another reality that is in line with the vision of our ancestors. Even the republic is a notion that our enemies created after they assassinated Jean-Jacques Dessalines in October of 1806. So for many of us, we're about getting rid of the republic and moving towards another reality that is in line with another world order, not, you know, the garbage that everybody is waiting for crumbs from these big powers. You cannot exist. You cannot do anything without the blessing of the United States. Haitians are looking at Venezuela. They're looking at the resources that this country has and looking at what in just such a short time the United States has done to Venezuela. And for us, there needs to be another reality in the world, not just in Haiti, for people around the world to understand that the UN is a sham. It's not just the OAS, but just this whole reality. We have to find another way to live as people on this planet.
As you said, there are lots of folks under many different banners in the streets. It's a broad-based upheaval. But Americans, most who know anything about Haiti, are familiar only with Lavalas, the organization associated with the deposed, overthrown by the United States in 2004, President Aristide. How deeply involved is Lavalas in all of this?
Yeah, Lavalas is one part of the opposition, and there are many other political parties. But what I want to point out is the protests that are happening, like in Wanamet, in Miambale, in Ukai, in so many different parts of the country, even in Port-au-Prince, this is not a political party or an opposition leader calling for these protests. This is the people being in the streets. One of the instigators of a part of this movement right now is like the movement asking for the Petro-Caribe money, which is about $2 billion that just disappeared, most of it under Martelly between 2011 and 2016, 2015. Now, this money, there are now three reports that are out. Well, four really. And the last one, after the last report came out, the second part of the Cour Supérieure des Comptes, which is like an administrative court dealing with the accounts of the country. In this report, basically, they went project by project, projects that were voted, contracts that were given without no bid contracts, that's how they call it, to cronies, projects. Like Jovenel Moïse himself, he got two monies, the same amount of money for the same project for two different companies. And he's the one who got this money, like millions of dollars. So people are like, come on, that's like a part of it. But beyond that, and there are different branches within that Petro-Caribe justice movement. There are people who are asking for him to step down, for him to be tried and things like that. And there are people who are saying there's no trial possible with this kind of system in place because the judges are judges that were put in by Martelly and Jovenel. You understand? Martelly's wife, she was in charge of these social programs called EDPEP, to help, let's help the people. And again, millions and millions of dollars money that was sent to money transfers through the telephone. This is a project that Bill Gates and Digicel, they were trying to get the country to function and with these money on the phone as opposed to cash money in your hand. And what the report finds is that thousands and thousands of phony phone numbers that didn't really exist, that they sent monies to the poor people to help them. So Stolen, the President Martelly's son, Olivier Martelly, supposedly in charge of building stadiums, a 25 soccer stadium around the country, and none of them really exist. It's just corruption. And these are all people, and the people are saying, like Martelly's son, Olivier, never worked a day in his life. And he's a multimillionaire in the country. So some people are saying judges that were put in by these people will never give justice. And so the only way to go is a total uprooting of the system that exists here. And it's not simply a toppling of one government so that another set of crooks, but it's for total uprooting of a system that's existed in our country, as I said, since the assassination of Dessalines in 1806.
That was Daoud André of the Committee to Mobilize Against Dictatorship in Haiti, speaking from Brooklyn, New York.
How should white parents go about raising children that do not perpetuate white supremacy and privilege? Jennifer Harvey has some ideas on that subject. Harvey is author of a new book titled Raising White Kids, Bringing Up Children in a Racially Unjust America. We asked Harvey if white kids need specialized treatment in a deeply racist society.
Yes, as you say, it's specialized treatment, but is not and shouldn't be special treatment. The reason that white kids and parents of white kids need specialized treatment and why it's not a book for all kids is that we know that in many, many, many families of color, African-American children, Latino children, are already from young ages being taught about race, being taught about racism, and being challenged, invited, supported perhaps in sort of navigating racism in the social environment towards the aim of racial justice. And we also know that white families don't do that. We know from all kinds of data that white parents are not talking about race explicitly with our children, and let alone talking about and modeling and mentoring anti-racism. And so we need to be having those conversations, and the reality is that when you're white in a white supremacist society, the strategies, the challenges, the conundrums of living into anti-racism and racial justice are different than if you are a person of color, and that white families have not created that narrative and those practices and that discourse and those postures. And so there's just a gaping sort of silence in white culture around anti-racist white parenting. And so this book really is trying to lean into that as part of the work of raising a multi-generational set of youth who are anti-racist committed actors.
Yes, you know, you speak of white kids as being behind black kids when it comes to race, which must strike some white parents and white folks in general as strange, since usually we speak of white kids being ahead in terms of educational opportunities and cultural opportunities, etc., rather than behind black kids.
Racial injustice gives white kids all kinds of access, of course, that puts them ahead around all kinds of, you know, markers of social well-being. And with that, it's astounding when I teach college and when my 19-year-old students walk into my classroom and I say, we're going to talk about race and we're going to study racism, students of color in my classroom, they are ready to go and, you know, say, like, yeah, let's do this. Let's have this conversation. Let's do this work. And white students literally freeze and panic, and they are sort of like, please, could we talk about abortion? That would be so much easier, you know. And what the reality is, and now I know to tell this to my students, is that what they're experiencing is me having said, okay, you all, we're going to do calculus today. And black students in my classes, Latino students, some Asian American students are like, oh, yeah, we've been doing calculus since we were 3 or 4 years old. And I say to the class, and if you are white in this class, you might have just be realizing, oh, people have basically barely taught me addition, and now you're going to expect me to do calculus. And so how are we going to do calculus together? We just, white silence in white families has left white youth unequipped and unable to talk about race, let alone to stand and actively be in solidarity against racial injustice. And we've got to address that.
In your experience, when you talk about the necessity for white kids, white people in general, to become versed on the racism that exists in this society, do they feel that's a burden?
Yeah, I'm sure lots of white folks do feel that as a burden. I tend to get to be in conversation with folks who may, even if they see it as a burden, still want to do it and want to figure it out. What I hear most often from white adults is that we don't know how to do it. Because many of us have never had any white person do it with us before, and some of us recognize that talking about race and doing anti-racist work with a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old who's white is just different. It's part of the same, it's relational, but it's a different set of needs for a white 3 or 4 or 5-year-old than it is for a child who's a child of color. And so white families or white parents will say to me, like, well, how do I talk about race with a 3-year-old, especially given that we live in a society that's so segregated, lots of white Americans don't even have people of color in their lives. And so white families literally just think, we don't know how to do this. No one's done it with us. How do you talk about race with a 3-year-old? And I try to respond, okay, well, here's some things that we need to do. And we need to just keep, we got to commit to continuing to figure this out because families of color have figured it out. It's not like they just sort of wanted to have that conversation. They have needed to have that conversation. And so we need to do it, too, if we're going to claim that we are committed to equity and justice.
And what are these different sets of needs that 3-year-old white kids have?
Well, part of the unique set of needs is that white silence in white family structures has been so profound that, you know, in some ways the actual need might be the same, but finding language for it is a different journey because whiteness in U.S. cultures has been so saturating in white family networks. So, for example, in white family networks, we get all this pressure from white culture to use language like, well, everybody's the same underneath their skin, and we just love everyone, so-called colorblindness. And so what happens is a three-year-old who's white needs is adults saying, no, look, difference, racial difference is everywhere, and it's beautiful, and it's wonderful, and let's talk about skin color difference, and let's talk about different racial identities, and let's talk about the fact that we are white, and to really make that a normal thing that we do as white Americans, that's one piece of it. And the other thing that our 3 and 4 and 5-year-olds need is adults in their lives who start to say things to them like, okay, when you heard that thing happen on the playground, because we actually know that kids, all kids, kind of quote-unquote play with race in social settings in the U.S. There's lots of studies that show this. We need to start when our kids are 3, 4, 5, saying, okay, when this thing happened, and give an example of, you know, sort of kid displays of racism, what does someone need to do when that happens? What would you do if you were a white person and you heard that happen, you heard someone making fun of an African-American child because of his skin? What would you do? And sort of make sort of the anti-racist moral imaginings part of our conversation with our children, just like we teach them about kindness and just like we teach them about sharing. We need to teach them about anti-racism in developmentally appropriate ways when they're 3, 4, 5, so that by the time they're 10 and 12, they're able to have even more sophisticated conversations about the reality of white supremacy in our society and to even more powerful ways of understanding the roles that white people can play in social justice movements for racial justice.
Yes, you say that children need concrete language about racial justice and anti-racism.
Yes.
What do you mean, concrete language?
Well, white families love to say things like, everybody's equal, or, you know, we just love everybody the same. Well, we know from all kinds of studies, besides just anecdotally through white behavior as kids grow up, that children don't know what that means. That's an abstract principle. And it's not the case that everyone may have innate equality and innate dignity, but not everyone experiences equality. So kids need concrete language like, for example, we value equality. We want everyone to have experience equality. And we live in a neighborhood or we live in a nation where people don't all experience equality, where there is a lot of inequality, and our young children need that concrete language. Or to give another example, we need to not just talk about, for example, when sometimes adults will take away the language of racism when they talk about racism, and they'll say, oh, you know, white people were mean to black people, for example, in the civil rights movement. We need to be concrete and say, yeah, many white people were mean to black people. They were treating black people unjustly. That's called racism. And racism is something that still exists today. And our family is fighting racism in these ways. And being concrete like that, that's how we give this sort of message around we love everybody the same. We actually give it flesh and blood when we are honest and truthful about racism, while also showing our kids that anti-racism is something we are committed to being about.
Every parent wants to give their kid a healthy sense of self, but you write, and I agree, of course, that a healthy white identity is an oxymoron in an unjust nation like America.
Yes. Glenn, that goes back a little bit to this specialized focus question, because it is not uncomplicated for me as a parent of two white children. My kids are 8 and 10. I want them to be healthy and have a sense of the world as having possibilities for them, to have a sense of themselves as people who can accomplish anything. But if I don't attend to the part where I teach them about the realities of white privilege, the realities of the ways that we have inherited unjust access through our own ancestral lines, if I don't talk with them about the truth about white supremacy in the United States, then I tell them you can do anything, and some of what they're able to do is because of their, you know, unjust access because of being white. I need to give them that sort of language and awareness. And that's a unique challenge to raising anti-racist white children and youth compared to the very severe challenges and focus that parents of children and youth of color have to navigate. And so, for example, you know, white kids, I've got to think about, okay, how do I both teach my child about the truth of white history and also support her in moving, you know, she's going to have to experience white guilt at some point in that, but I don't want her to get stuck there. I want to support her in moving through that so she can speak truthfully about what she has inherited and what we've inherited because of our ancestors and how it shows up in our lives in the present. But she can also say, that doesn't have to be the only thing I am. I don't only have to be an, you know, unjustly benefit from privilege. I also can forge relationships of accountability with people of color where I am in the struggle for racial justice, and so that she doesn't sort of get stuck in white guilt the way lots of white Americans do. And so that's some of the examples around the sort of special, unique challenges of being someone who is maybe committed to equality and equity and justice, but who is benefiting from injustice every single day. We've got to figure out how we navigate that, not just ourselves as adults, but how we support our children in navigating that.
And you seem to be consciously raising some radical children. You write that standing up for justice in the U.S. requires a willingness to challenge relentlessly circulating myths about this nation's history and its heroes.
Yeah, I mean, I hope I'm raising radical children. I hope my kids, you know, we talk about when in parenting cultures, you're supposed to follow the rules and you're supposed to listen to your teacher and do what your teacher says. Well, then what happens when we have a president who's talking about, oh, law and order, the rule is you don't cross this border. How do I, as a white adult, teach my child how to enter the immigration conversation in a humanizing, anti-racist way if I don't also teach her, guess what, sometimes you break the rules, because saying that this is the law is a dehumanizing, racist way of talking about dark-skinned people, people from Mexico and Guatemala and El Salvador who are fleeing for their lives. Or if I just tell my kids, you know, you got to do what your teacher says, and I do want to teach them to respect their teachers, and yet their teachers are only giving them certain kind of messages about people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. I need to teach my child that you question authority, that you challenge teachers, you know, and that you sort of don't assume people in authority are correct. And that runs counter to lots of parenting culture, but certainly runs counter to white parenting cultures when we aren't, you know, encouraging our kids to challenge and question authority. That's got to be a value in terms of how I'm parenting my two young white children if I think they're going to grow a healthy sense of anti-racist agency in the world.
There are lots of precincts in the United States, and not just down south, where 90% or so of the households vote Republican. How do you think your methodology for teaching your children or teaching kids would be received in those precincts?
Well, that's a really good question. And I imagine in many of those precincts, just the very notion that the U.S. is racially unjust, unfortunately, is even up for discussion in those precincts. It's hard for me to fathom how that's not even considered just a fact. And certainly there's folks who have no interest in thinking about raising an anti-racist generation of white children. Having said that, I've been a little bit surprised to even have had a couple moments. One review, actually, of Raising White Kids came from someone who lives in Texas and who got the book as a joke and who had voted for Trump and ended up writing a pretty amazing review about how the stories in it sort of just were so compelling in terms of their accuracy and their sort of honesty and sort of humanity that would sort of impact how he was thinking about these questions. But I do think that we are in a real crisis in this country. I think what I hope is that the way I speak with and to folks in my networks who might be voting for someone who is, you know, growing white nationalism in this country, and the way I teach my children to talk about and challenge those folks that they are going to be in, you know, family networks with. I hope that what part of what the message of the book is and the capacity that the book might enable among some white folks is a sort of clarity about the urgency of constantly speaking up about those issues and not letting sort of niceness and family sort of smoothness and connection to sort of silence us and model for our children that we should be silent when racism is happening, but instead that the book helps folks feel emboldened to really speak up and to the white people we have access to who are, you know, voting for right-wing white nationalist political leaders. That's my hope.
Yes, we live in a country in which lots of white people are near hysterical at the prospect of them becoming minorities.
Yeah, we do. I don't know quite what we do about that, Glenn. That is a problem that sometimes keeps me up at night. That hysteria is a really frightening emotional dynamic to have going on in this society. I don't understand it. I don't understand the fear of becoming the demographic minority, but the existence of that fear really gives me pause and makes me tremble in terms of the challenges we're going to be facing politically in the next few years as people try and retain power.
Yes, and it makes it more imperative, I'm sure you think, to get on with the teaching of the young.
It absolutely does, and especially a teaching of the young that uses and talks about and engages white kids and youth around this language of whiteness and anti-racism. Because one of the things going on in this country, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, even though it was mostly done before the 2016 election, is that white youth, because they have had parents and teachers who have not talked about or modeled anti-racist white identity journey, those white youth, when they hear that we're supposed to value diversity, when they are challenged or invited to think about embodying relationships in multiracial space, they are so unequipped that for high school-aged youth, that can often translate into anxiety and guilt and fear that unfortunately is actually emotional dispositions that become ripe for the picking for white nationalists. I think we're facing a kind of crisis among sort of teenage age youth, white youth, who have not had good anti-racist white mentoring, and thus, as they sort of feel unequipped to navigate multiracial space, the white nationalists are like, hey, we've got something for you, and they are recruiting those young people. I mean, those images from Charlottesville, those were young people, and that gives me chills, and that makes this work really urgent. We have to break silence. I want to fight for white youth. I want to fight for white youth. I want to pull them away from the allure of white nationalism, and I think all of us who are parents of white kids, teachers of white kids, pastors, coaches, whoever we are, we have a moral obligation to do that and to figure out how to do it. The one thing that I would want to say, and especially say to folks who might be listening, who may, if they are themselves white or have white kids and feel daunted at this, one of the myths of white supremacy and white culture is that we as white adults have to have all the answers all the time. And one of the most important things I've been learning with my own children is that parenting for racial justice has meant many times realizing in a moment I didn't quite know the exact right thing to say, and learning to say to my own kids, you know what, I actually don't know the answer to that, or learning to say to them, you know, I'm really uncomfortable with what we just saw or what I just heard you say, but I'm not sure why, and I want to talk about it later. And sort of seeing my kids as on a journey with me and me on a journey with them, where we are discovering the answers to how we grow our anti-racist family values more deeply together, as opposed to me thinking I've got to always exactly have the right answers. I think a lot of white adults don't bring up issues of race or racism because we're afraid we're going to get it wrong. And it's so much more important that we break silence, even if we don't exactly have it all correct, and then make sure we do our work to get it in an everyday kind of way more and more correct as we go.
That was author Jennifer Harvey.
Marquis Bay is a PhD candidate in the English department at Cornell University. He thinks the language of hip-hop provides insight on potential new ways to build societies. Bay is author of the new book, Them Goon Rules, Fugitive Essays on Radical Black Feminism. But what does he mean by Them Goon Rules?
I take the title actually from a line in hip-hop artist Lil Wayne's 2008 song, A Millie. And he's an artist, I want to be clear, I don't necessarily love per se, but I found something really incredibly insightful in one of the lines in there where he says, and I'm quoting, I go by them goon rules. If you can't beat them, then you pop them. So when he says that I go by them goon rules, I want to try to think about that as a way of living in the world, by which I mean, if there's another way that we can live, if there are other rules that we can live by, rules of the goon, if you will, then how might that offer a different, a more just, a kind of a more livable life that we can inhabit in the world? So I wanted to try to really think about that as an alternative, as what I call in the book, an otherwise mode of living that allows us to live more free, if you will. So that's what I'm getting at with the title.
So you think you can find insights into other ways of living in the regular speech of people, or even in the rappings of hip-hop artists?
Absolutely. Yeah, there is something. I mean, I grew up in Philly, and hip-hop was, in many ways, our unofficial language. So there's a way that the vernacular, that the Black English, that the slang, all those different kinds of dialects and idioms can offer another way of languaging ourselves in the world. And I'm thinking along the lines of that as what I mean by a way to speak a different kind of existence into the world. So if we have standard speech, which is riddled with various kinds of assumptions and rooted in a particular demographic, one that itself is then rooted in, say, white and male supremacy, then if we look at the vernacular, the dialect of, say, hip-hop or Black English, then that might provide another glimpse into another way of thinking about how we might speak a different kind of existence into the world. So I look to that precisely because those other kinds of denigrated speeches might, in fact, be a more salvific way of speaking and living ourselves in the world differently, in a way that is in excess of the various kinds of fetters and violences that betide us.
Yes, you say that the vernacular, that is the way regular people talk, is also theoretical. Explain that.
Yeah, I'm drawing heavily on this Black feminist theorist named Barbara Christian. And in her canonical essay, A Race for Theory, she says that her people, which is to say Black people, have always theorized, but in the form of the hieroglyph. So what she's talking about there is a way of theorizing, a way of thinking in a sophisticated way that is not simply the musings of dead white philosophers, but how does the vernacular, the everyday speech of, say, Black people, how is that a kind of theorizing, but in a different form? And how might that different form itself be a different way of thinking about the world and living in the world? So there is such richness to me in the vernacular, precisely because there is a richness there that is untapped or that has not been tapped as much as, say, the theorizing of literary theorists, philosophers, et cetera. There's something really, I think, generative in the language of the marginalized, the language of the oppressed, precisely because it's coming from a different kind of angle, a different and more distinct angle of vision that might in fact be more capacious and broad than the narrow language that has been given to us.
Yes, this is very interesting. Marxism teaches us that the hegemony of the bourgeoisie, that is the rule of rich white men, permeates the society and infuses all of its institutions with the values of the bourgeoisie and therefore solidifies their rule. You're talking about a counter way of thinking and living exemplified or expressed in the language of those who are oppressed by that bourgeoisie.
Yes, absolutely. And I love Barthes, and there's one line that I always kind of return to where he's talking about the ruthless criticism of all that exists. And that, I think, is really hefty with a way of encountering the world. For me, the vernacular, the Black English, is a way to get at a different way of speaking and living. That there is itself a kind of ruthless criticism of the very mechanisms that structure the reality, that structure how we are said to think and be in the world. So if the hieroglyphic vernacular, if you will, of Black English is a different mode of critiquing of the status quo, then in that we find a different way of getting outside of the bourgeoisie, getting outside of the hegemonic, the normative, etc.
Yes, lots of people have noted that Black folks, or certainly Black folks from the lower classes, invert the value system in order to not be on the bottom, so that bad becomes very good.
Yes, exactly, exactly. That's, I think, one of the beauties of Black English and vernacular, where the way that it does something incredibly creative with language. And if I'm understanding language, not simply as things that we say, words that we say, but itself as, in, say, Heideggerian terms of Martin Heidegger, the philosopher, if he says that language speaks us, then language then is the kind of structure that allows us to understand reality in many ways. So there's something, I think, quite rich in how Black English and vernacular is doing something incredibly different and radically departing from the given status quo language that can perhaps create a different way of understanding ourselves and the world as we live in it.
You write in the piece that you did for Black Agenda Report that Black feminism, broadly conceived, gives us an accurate glimpse into the gizzards and guts of the political climate. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I'm thinking alongside a range of Black feminist thinkers, Patricia Hill Collins, chief among them, that Black women, which is not to be reduced to Black feminism, but Black women are constitutive of Black feminism. Black feminism, then, is a distinct angle of vision, Patricia Hill Collins says. And that means that by virtue of, in particular, cis white male supremacy, and by virtue of that, Black women and Black feminism, then, is positioned in a way that is forced to think about the nuances of power dynamics in the world. So Black feminism then becomes, to me, the broadest and most capacious and most accurate glimpse into the workings of the world, precisely because it has to reckon with all these forces of power and navigate them in dexterous ways because of how that power is positioning Black women and Black feminism. So that's what I, in many ways, mean by that, that Black feminism gives us an acute insight into the workings of power and how power has structured various relations among us.
You seem to be making a kind of critique of rather recent Black political radical history in writing that you want to get away from a masculinist texture that implies incendiary conflagrations and armed revolution. What's wrong with incendiary conflagrations and armed revolution?
So historically, there's the assumption, and it's coming largely from Black masculine subjects, which I want to make a distinction between Black masculine subjects and Black men. I don't see those two things as the same. So there seems to be a trend in Black liberatory history that a kind of blowing things up, if you will, is going to get things done. Whereas to me, it seems that Black feminists have thought in more sophisticated and nuanced ways about that. If we just blow things up, then we're left with the rubble and ashes and perhaps even many casualties there that I don't think attend to the kind of care that Black feminists have in many ways made their priority, caring for the most marginalized. So I want to turn to Black feminism because I'm thinking about how we might allow for the most proliferation of life rather than the most pervasive destruction. I'm interested in generating things and creating things, not simply the destruction, which is not to say that there is no destruction in the world in which we want to live, but it's to say that there's always, to me, a thinking about the creation and world building that is integral to this project rather than simply blowing things up. And that's what I mean by that.
Yes, you talk about envisioning new worlds and starting to live in those new worlds. But how do you live in a new world when you still have the hegemony of the white bourgeoisie?
Absolutely. There's, I think, a way to live in a different kind of world in the world. So this is to say that it's not simply the task of me or other folks with whom I am in solidarity and coalition. It's not simply the task of getting rid of this world and then creating another world, but how are we already living that new world within this world? If this is perhaps the only world we have, how are we creating and cultivating spaces that actualize this world in which we want to live? How are we refusing the imposed tenets given to us and structuring our lives and communities in ways that index the way we want to live after we get rid of or after we overcome, refuse the various violences that are in our midst? I want to think in terms of what Tina Camp calls a Black feminist grammar. How do we live the future now? That, to me, is the goal here, living that future now, with not within the terms that have already been set, but with different terms that we have at our disposal that we create that are in defiance of and refusal of the world that we've been giving. I want to try to think about how we might live simply amid all the things that are betiding us and yet not succumb to those things.
Frankly, it sounds to me like you're talking about having some very interesting conversations and interactions, but not making any revolution.
Oh, we are absolutely having interesting interactions and conversations. Those things, to me, are the bedrock of revolution. It seems to me that a revolution cannot happen without these conversations and this tinkering with the logics and mechanisms in place. So I think those two are not mutually exclusive, but that the conversation, the conversating, as my ancestors might say, is absolutely crucial and vital for the revolution. It's difficult to know what will happen once the revolution comes if we have not talked about and discussed and worked through it beforehand.
Before most writers finish with their books, they have another one in mind. What's next with you?
Yeah, I'm working on a few projects, actually. One of my projects is a more academic project, and that's on Black trans feminism. It's in many ways furthering what I do in Them Goon Rules, and is trying to think about how we might think through Black feminism and trans feminism together, and what might that kind of social movement, what might that apparatus look like. And then another project I'm working on is another collection of creative nonfiction essays on masculinity. And then the third book project I'm working on, which is a very brief project, is on Black anarchism and how the history of anarchism might be forced to go a different kind of course or might be forced to do different kinds of work when encountering Blackness. So those are the three projects I'm working on right now, and they're in very different stages at the moment.
Well, give us an example of past and present Black anarchism.
Yes, the black anarchism of, say, Lorenzo Irvin. His anarchism is very much an attempt to think about where are the black people in the history of anarchism. So if we have Proudhon and Godwin and Stirner, all these classical canonical anarchists, Irvin wants to find where are the black people who were in these social movements or who adhered to anarchism's tenets. Whereas now I'm thinking in the vein of, say, someone like Zoe Samudzi, who's a black feminist anarchist, and she wants to think not simply about where are the black people in anarchism, but how is the black radical tradition itself a kind of anarchic strain, or where are the anarchic practices and textures in the black radical tradition and in the black feminist tradition? So it's a distinction from, or it's a move from, finding people who are black who are also anarchists, and more toward how is the black radical tradition itself doing things with and to anarchism.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.